Welcome to the market, sponsored by the CME Group, Dateline Chicago, Friday, January 27. We have survived 1 week of a Trump administration, and in that week we saw the Dow Industrial Average break through the 20,000 mark finally and hold it at above 20,000 through the end of the week. Now, all of that should be credited to Donald Trump? Probably not, but business seems to like some of the cutbacks on regulation and other activities that he carried on through executive order this week. But it's always a question mark. What do you see next? Because at the same time, he did some cutting back of overregulation. He also said, we're not going to negotiate any more in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, and we are going to take apart NAFTA that has been in effect since the mid-90s between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. It'll be interesting to see if bilateral trade agreements will work better than the larger trade agreements we have been involved in. One of the questions that a lot of us will have is how quickly can they move forward on getting new agreements in place, whether it be bilateral or multiple countries, because over the decades that I have been watching trade agreements and trade rules being discussed, it's about as exciting as watching paint dry. It does not happen very quickly. So let's see where we ended the week on Wall Street. Today, stock market down for a second consecutive session, some corporate earnings that did not impress, some gross domestic product data that offset the recent enthusiasm over policy actions by President Trump. U.S. economic growth slowed more than expected in the fourth quarter, with the gross domestic product rising at a 1.9% annual rate. That's below the 2.2% increase expected by economists and the 3.5% growth pace that was logged in the third quarter. Some other downward news today. Chevron down 2.5% after its quarterly profit fell short of analyst expectations. The stock, really the biggest drag on the S&P 500 and the Dow indices. The S&P Energy Index down 0.9%. That was the worst performing of the 11 major S&P sectors. But while we saw fuel for our vehicles go down, we saw fuel for our bodies also go down. Starbucks, it held back gains on the NASDAQ. Its shares dropped 4% to $56.12. after the world's biggest coffee maker seller trimmed its full-year revenue forecast. And even with some disappointing corporate results, however, fourth quarter earnings are expected to show growth of 6.8%. That would mark the biggest increase in 2 years and the second straight quarter of growth, according to data from Thomson Reuters. And, of course, the Dow remained above 20,000 for the third straight day after beating the milestone for the first time on Wednesday. Now, for the week, the Dow up 1.3%. The S&P 500 gained 1%, and the NASDAQ gained nearly 2%. Some of the tech stocks were in the news today. Certainly, Microsoft up 2.3%, while Intel gained 1.1% after both companies reported quarterly results above Wall Street expectations. However, Google parent Alphabet down 1.4% after it posted fourth quarter profit below the estimate of analysts. And Colgate-Palmolive dropped over 5% after the personal products maker's fourth quarter revenue missed, again, expectations of traders and analysts on Wall Street. But all in all, for the final trading week of January, not a bad performance, particularly when you take a look to a year ago and the terrible start we had on Wall Street just 1 year ago. Certainly a different picture today. Maybe that's one of the reasons why the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index hit its highest level in today's report since January of 2004. So let's look ahead to next week and what will be we be looking at in the marketplace. First of all, the Dow components featuring in the earnings lineup next week, Apple reporting first quarter results on Tuesday, along with Pfizer scheduled to report fourth quarter results the same day. Meanwhile, Thursday, we'll see Merck & Company and Visa report their fourth quarter and first quarter results, respectively. And ExxonMobil, the world's largest publicly traded oil company, reports fourth quarter results on Friday. Apple is expected to report its first increase in quarterly revenue in a year, helped by sales of the revamped iPhone 7. And Apple is forecasting all-time record revenues between $76 and $78 billion. And investors and analysts will be looking out for the company's comments on the smartphone industry and expectations for its next iPhone range. They're coming up to, the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. So it'll be interesting to see what, if any, kind of promotion they stage for that event. On matters outside earnings reports, Tuesday, the Federal Open Market Committee begins a two-day meeting on interest rate policy, and this is the first meeting since Donald Trump became president. Last month, the Fed added 25 basis points to borrowing costs, but that's only its second increase since the Great Recession and a year since the first one. Last December, policymakers signaled as many as three increases in 2017, but no hike is expected on Wednesday. They're expecting rates will remain at 0.50 to 0.75% until the second quarter. Then they're looking for a 25 basis point increase likely, according to a Reuters poll. And then later, Friday of next week, Chicago Fed President Charles Evans scheduled to speak on the economic outlook and why the U.S. Central Bank plans to raise interest rates this year. So back to the earnings reports and some of the other companies we'll be hearing from. The social media giant Facebook expected to post a jump in fourth quarter revenue on Wednesday of next week. Online retail giant Amazon.com expected to report an increase in fourth quarter profit and revenue on Thursday. Tuesday, an increase in fourth quarter profit expected for MasterCard, the world's second biggest payments processor, and Eli Lilly and Company's fourth quarter results expected before the bell on Tuesday, likely to be affected by a $150 million charge associated with the failed trial of its watched Alzheimer's drug in November. Aetna reports fourth quarter results on Tuesday, and investors will be focused on what the industry leader CEO Mark Bertolini has to say about anticipated changes to the health insurance market under, if it happens, a revised Obamacare. The largest U.S. life insurer, MetLife, expected to report on Wednesday, and they're looking for a slight increase in quarterly profit, helped by an increase expected in investment income. MetLife and other insurers in 2017 are expected to see continued benefits from rising interest rates and lower corporate taxes under President Trump's administration. What about other government reports? Well, wages, manufacturing, and payrolls data next week expected to underscore the economy's strong fundamentals, which were highlighted by solid domestic demand in the fourth quarter. Labor Department expected to report on Tuesday that its employment cost index increased 0.6% in the fourth quarter. Other reports on Tuesday expected to show rising consumer confidence and sustained gains in house prices. Wednesday, the Institute for Supply Management expected to report that its National Manufacturing Activity Index increased to 55 in January, up slightly from 54.7 in December. And then, of course, on Friday, we end the week with the Labor Department's employment report. Here's what they're expecting as of now. They're expecting the employment report will show non-farm payrolls increased by 171,000 jobs in January, picking up from December's 156,000 gain, and the unemployment rate is expected to hold steady near the 9-year low of 4.7%. Oh, a couple of others. Sprint Corporation, the wireless carrier, expected to post an increase in third quarter revenue on Tuesday. Medical device maker Boston Scientific expected to report its fourth quarter results before the bell Thursday. And Hershey Company, we'll end on a sweet note. Hershey Company will report fourth quarter results on Friday. The maker of Hershey's Kisses and Reese's Peanut Butter Cups had raised its full-year profit forecast in October as demand strengthened in its full-year profit forecast in the United States, and the company spent less on advertising and marketing. So a busy week just ended, another busy week straight ahead. The world of commodities, well, we'll get to that with Max Armstrong and a first-time guest here on The Markets when we continue, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
On The Market, sponsored by the CME Group, we are fortunate to have many friends in the commodity business who are analyzers and traders and investors. And this week, we turn to a first-timer, certainly not in the markets, but joining us here on The Markets, Clayton Pope, Clayton Pope Commodities, with offices from North Dakota to North Carolina, but they're based in Champaign. And he joins us this week along with Max Armstrong. And as I've said often, in the Northern Hemisphere in the wintertime, we don't do any farming. We go to meetings, Outlook meetings and other events that help us prepare for the year ahead. And we spend a lot more time focusing on weather in South America. So that's Max's opening question, how the Brazil and Argentine weather looks favorable for crop growth right now. And at the end, well, we'll find out at the end just what he had to say. But right now, here's Max with that South American question.
Looking at the forecast for South America, the weather forecasts seem kind of benign right now. There's nothing terribly worrisome for those growers, and that means it's not especially friendly for ours, I guess.
That's the way I see it, Max. They definitely had some problems for a while there. Argentina was just inundated with some real heavy rains. But right now, even though there's a real wide variety of conditions, it's obviously a big continent, it seems like for the most part, things are on the mend. You still have maybe 10 to 15% of both Argentina and Brazil that are kind of relative trouble spots for sure. But that other 85% is pretty darn good. And as a whole, looks like South American production is looking like a pretty good number right now.
Usually during the harvest season, there's some kind of a hiccup. You know, an elevator conveyor catches on fire, or the truckers get disgruntled and they'll block some streets or port facilities or major highways. What's your feeling about through this harvest? Is there one more opportunity for some kind of a friendly influence here on the market, if only for a day or two?
Oh, I think so, definitely. I mean, especially with the growing advent or importance of the safrinha crop in Brazil, it's such an extended growing period down there that we're hardly out of the woods yet. And I think last year's very late problems are still fresh in so many traders' minds that whereas before last year, maybe at this point, they were ready to kind of put the nail in the coffin and assume numbers were safe. That's certainly not the case this year. So even though right now it seems like things are pretty good and in general, looking at some good numbers, The safrinha crop, for example, the second corn crop in Brazil, it's only now just beginning to be planted, and that's really twice as big as their first corn crop. So we still have a lot of uncertainty ahead of us. So I expect the resultant volatility will come with that.
Have the Chinese buyers made the switch to South American origin?
No, I think they're slowly, moving that direction. But it seems like every year their buying spree period sort of extends a little bit further and a little bit further, and that's still the case. I mean, this morning there were some more sales to unknown destinations, which the general tendency of the trade is to assume that's China, although that's not always the case. But from all appearances, they're still continuing to buy, but definitely that activity is waning and the switch is underway.
Am I correct that their buying has exceeded the projections, the WASDE numbers, for example? Aren't they a little bit ahead of what had been forecast?
They are indeed, and that's sort of the recurring pattern of the last, 3 years certainly, and really about four out of the last five. The USDA has made the mistake of underestimating the ultimate number, and then only to beginning about now with each supply and demand as it rolls out on a monthly basis, they would keep inching those export demand numbers up, and then result in a lower carryover. And a lot of the trade, I think, is assuming that's going to happen again this year. And we think there's certainly some room for an increase in exports, but we don't think it's going to be anything like last year, which ended up being quite a dramatic increase, even from this late date on. That reduced the carryover considerably. So the carryover now is 420 million bushels in the U.S. You could argue maybe that dropped possibly another 100 million, but I'd be very surprised if it dropped more than that, and that would still leave us with a very large and comfortable carryover.
Looking back at the past year, there's been so much focus on the diminishing growth, the slowing growth of the Chinese economy. Has that stopped now, that slowing of the growth? I'd heard that maybe it had plateaued a little bit.
I think I'd have to agree with that assessment. I mean, it's obviously been amazing. You hear them complaining about a 7 or 8% GDP or something like that when, dwarfs ours right now. But I think so. I mean, as they kind of become more and more mature, this modern thriving economy of theirs, I think it is going to be expected to be a little bit less and less of a wonder kid. And it'll kind of start looking at a little bit more normal growth rates.
As a veteran trader and analyst, you've watched the negotiation of trade agreements. You've watched how they've played out, how they've been implemented, and how they've worked for American farmers. What's your sense about what is happening now? Cutting the legs out from under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as the new president has done, and wanting to renegotiate NAFTA, which American farmers generally feel has served them pretty well.
Yes. Boy, you're really raising a huge cloud of uncertainty there. And there's just an awful lot of unanswered questions, which obviously the world and the trade is going to have to kind of wade through here.
Has it shown up at all in the pricing of our commodities?
I'd venture to say not in any significant way or obvious way, I don't think. I mean, it sort of adds to the general uncertainty. I think the biggest fear in my mind and others, too, is with us pulling out of the TPP, which, I mean, it was hardly a foregone conclusion that was ever going to be approved anyway. But it's obviously a dead issue now. But the biggest fear, I think, going forward here is China has made some very clear remarks that they intend to be more and more of a world player, if not a maker of policy. And I think, there's a very good chance that they will go ahead and forge some type of, Asian trade agreement, which could possibly even include Russia and almost certainly the exclusion of us. So we're kind of wading into some uncharted territory for sure. So it's not just the stopping or pulling out of TPP, but probably more important is what the heck is going to fill that void, if you want to look at it that way.
But someone might say, playing the devil's advocate here for a moment, they need our stuff. The Chinese are going to come here anyway, are they not, and buy what we need, whether it's soybeans or pork or increasingly, it seems, beef. They have the growing population. Do they not need it?
Yeah, that argument carries a lot of merit, no doubt about that. But let's face it, when we're looking at the export numbers that we are and the heavy dominance that China plays in that role, particularly in the soybean complex, any changes can seem like even a minor percentage has some pretty dramatic implications in terms of, you know, how that would fall through to our carryover, for example. Sure, they have a lot of hungry mouths to feed, and now that they've embarked on these improved diets and so forth, they'd have a real hard time forcing their populace, I think, to go back to, you know, a diet that's, you know, not improved like it has in recent years. But I think there's still room for them if they wanted to, whether it's for political reasons, you know, punishment, as you will. There's certainly room for them to shift, you know, whatever, 20% or something of their purchases from us to South America. And that would be felt in a very big way by us. So I think, you know, going forward, there's this huge fear of some type of trade war. Personally, I would like to think that Trump is kind of talking tough here now to sort of improve his negotiating stance. And we all know he's certainly considers himself a very good negotiator. And I think by trying to improve his stance, you know, he's kind of drawing a tough line there. But on the other hand, he knows how important our ag exports are. And when push comes to shove, I, for one, am a very serious doubter that it will be anything catastrophic.
The North American Free Trade Agreement has much more in it than agriculture. And of course, that's one thing he has talked about, President Trump has talked about repeatedly, is the need to have more of these products, such as automobiles that are destined for showrooms in the United States, made in the United States. Can he accomplish all that? Can he bring back some manufacturing jobs and not hurt the other side of the ledger, the part that's important to farmers, livestock producers, ranchers?
Well, there's a lot of issues in your question there, but
you count on a farm broadcaster to ask a long question, like I'm giving a speech or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as a one-handed economist, right?
That's right.
But I would have to think that, well, for one thing, I think they have to, you know, from the administration standpoint, is probably more focused on manufacturing jobs than agricultural jobs, although certainly, you know, agriculture is a big part of it. I think, you know, there's some big concerns there. I think maybe we'll be better off if we can just negotiate unilaterally with the different countries involved instead of kind of throwing us all together in the same agreement. It seems like that is fraught with some longer-term problems. But
which is what he wants to do, right? More unilateral agreements?
That's my understanding, and it seems like it would be easier to you know, tailor-make the agreements and to deal with the specific quid pro quo, that kind of thing. You know, the give and take involved in any kind of negotiation, it seems like it would be easier to accomplish and protect our, accomplish certain goals and protect our interests dealing on a one-on-one basis that way as opposed to, you know, just sort of a blanket all-encompassing agreement.
Clayton Pope Commodity, Champaign, Illinois. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
There is no question that ladies are playing a more important role in farm operations and ownership these days. When I was a kid, Mom cooked the meals, took care of the kids, helped milk cows, and once in a while drove a tractor. But today, ladies on farms and ranches are doing so much more. And Kalina Bruce is a lady we met in Phoenix at the American Farm Bureau Federation Convention earlier this month. She had just been elected chair of the Farm Bureau Young Farmers and Ranchers Committee. That's an important active group. But let's learn about her background.
I am from Southwest Missouri, a little town called Stockton in Cedar County. My husband and I, we are cow-calf operation, commercial cow-calf operation. We also, with my mother and my sister's family, have an agritourism venture. So we do, you pick strawberries, blackberries, raspberries, blueberries as well. And that keeps us busy spring through summer. And then we offer a corn maze and a pumpkin patch in the fall. And that takes care of October. So off the farm, I am a CPA, and I also have a firm with my sister as well. So, you know, family's very important to us. We, you know, my parents instilled that in us. So we work together as a family, we play together as a family, and we farm together as a family. And that's, you know, That's a huge part of Farm Bureau. That's what makes it an easy fit for myself and my family in this organization. So.
And your husband has an off-farm job, I
understand. He does. So him and his brother and his father, they have an auction business, Bruce and Leanne Auction Company, and been in business for 40 years. So we do stay busy, that's for sure.
So did you aspire to become chairperson of this committee, or did it happen?
So when the opportunity to possibly sit on the YFNR, the committee on the national level, came about, my husband and I discussed that might be a good fit for me to lead such a talented group of individuals and agriculture advocates. So, yes, it's been about a four-year aspiration for me.
As I mentioned, you will join one other woman on the board of the American Farm Bureau. What kind of input do you want to make to the board members when you discuss policy?
Well, just want to reiterate the importance of the young farmer and rancher. You know, we are the next generation, and we're raising that next generation, and we want our voices to be heard. So.
And any feelings at the moment on policy that you would like to see that could benefit young farmers?
So, you know, immigration is a huge policy for us, and taxes as well. So being a CPA off the farm gives me a little bit of an insight on how the tax code works and how it really affects people and what we fight, you know, to try to protect, you know, our farm ground, our legacy, our parents' legacy. So, you know, I'm really interested in hoping to see the tax code changed in the next couple years.
And a final question. You have a child.
Mm-hmm.
Are you concerned about the safety of what she is consuming?
You know, we say that we practice safe farming practices, and, you know, we do have the UPIC berries, and we have people out to the farm all the time, and they want to know, are these organic, non-GMO, gluten-free, all of that good stuff. And so, you know, I say, there she is right there. She's out in the field, and she's eating right from the plant, you know. So while we don't practice some of those niche markets, it's still a safe food source for my daughter, and I'm not worried about that at all. As farmers, we're good stewards of the land, and we know what's good for us and for our kids.
So at this moment, you see farming, ranching as your future?
Correct. We do.
Well, congratulations, Kalina, and thank you for the visit here in Phoenix, Arizona, at the annual meeting of the American Farm Bureau, a visit with chairperson of the Young Farmers and Ranchers Committee, Kalina Bruce.
Thank you.
Kalina Bruce, indeed, adding her voice now to the board of directors of the American Farm Bureau Federation. She will sit on that board with one other lady, Sherry Saylor, who is chair of the Farm Bureau Women's Leadership Committee, and I know they will both bring a great deal of insight into the dealings of the American Farm Bureau Board of Directors. Well, next week, Max Armstrong joins about 5,000-6,000 people at the Opryland Hotel in Nashville, Tennessee. It's annual meeting time for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Max will be there representing, of course, the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. He serves as president of that group. And he'll also be moderating part of the convention program. One of the topics, of course, the December feedlot report that we received this afternoon, showing that in the month of December, feedlots added 18% more cattle than the same month a year ago. Higher prices for slaughter-ready cash cattle last month improved profit for feedlots, and some ranchers pulled heavy calves off pastures to avoid potential illness and death loss from the onset of wintry weather. But as we take a look at those numbers, as seen through the eyes of Dennis Smith of Archer Financial Services, he said the number of cattle on feed, 100% compared to a year ago, placements up 18%, and marketing's up 7%. He said the largest placement rate during December in 6 years. So where do we start the livestock trade on Monday? Well, cattle futures ended today with February at 118.32, March feeder cattle at 127.45, and the February lean hog contract ended at 66.90. And then in the grain trade, we're going to be looking at weather in South America as a factor again. Wheat futures touching a two-week low today on plentiful supplies. Corn and soybean futures posted modest declines. We are out of time. Thank you for joining us. Max Armstrong, I'm Orion Samuelson. On the Market, sponsored by the CME Group.